All right, friends. That man, that chicken sounds a little bit weird now, like he needs some help. Oh, man, that's actually me. Some of you don't know that. Many, many years ago, I was goofing around, but the mic was on, and they recorded that, and that became a central part of an essential part of the launch of the show. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason on with Tim Barnett. You still with me, Tim?
I am here, and I am curious if you can still make that chicken noise. I think that's our audience wants to hear.
No, those were the days. I actually was doing a whole bunch of different noises and animal sounds on that day. So, but that was a different era of my life.
Yeah.
But Tim is here helping me co-host the show today, and I thought maybe at this hour, why don't you just launch out? And I know you've got some things on your mind, a book that you've been reading about progressive Christianity. And we talked just a little bit about it when we were setting up for the show, the first hour. So I'm just going to, you know, pass the baton to you and let you take it from here, and I'll interact with you instead of you interacting with me. This is some important things I think you've been looking at.
This is going to be great because we haven't really talked about how some of the things I'm going to read to you, and I want to get your kind of raw reaction to some of these things. But just to let our audience know what we're referring to. So I've been doing quite a bit of research on the topic of deconstruction. And one of the books
which
is the idea. Now, this is actually hard to define, really. The idea is that there are a number of Christians or people who are professing to be Christians that are taking their belief system and dissecting it, breaking it down to its kind of fundamental parts. They're deconstructing it. And that's the term that really is relatively new, but the concept has been around since the beginning. Okay, so take a belief, whatever it may be, God's existence, resurrection, deity of Christ, and just start to question it and take it down to its basic building blocks, essentially.
So it's for deconstruction, then, is more than just breaking the elements of the faith into parts. I mean, that is systematic theology.
Yeah.
You know, you got theology about God, you've got about Christ, you got about man, you got a soteriology, salvation, you got end times and eschatology and all that. This is different. It's breaking the pieces down for the purposes of challenging their legitimacy. Would that be fair? Okay.
I think that's a good way to put it, Greg. It's not merely questioning, and this is something I've been spending a lot of time recently thinking about. What is the distinction between questioning, doubting, and deconstructing? What I find is that these terms are being used synonymously. And so, you know, you'll have people in books like what I'm going to share from. This is Before You Lose Your Mind. And the subtitle is Deconstructing Bad Theology in the Church. And it's basically a bunch of progressive Christians that want you to deconstruct your faith so that you will reconstruct your faith into some kind of progressive theology. Okay. So beliefs like the exclusivity of Christ, Jesus is the only way, you got to get rid of it. Deconstruct it. Your traditional view of sexuality, got to go. The idea that God is violent in the Old Testament or pours out wrath and judgment, this kind of thing, got to go. The idea of hell, no, universalism. So they're kind of making an appeal for progressive Christianity, but the way you get there is through deconstruction. So, I mean, I want to be fair to them. They definitely advocate for asking questions, which I'm all for, asking questions. But they're asking questions for a very specific purpose, okay? And I mentioned this, you know, maybe it was earlier today, that the deconstructionist actually doesn't like the apologist. At least these deconstructionists don't, because the apologist says, yes, ask your questions, and we would like to show you the answers. Some of these answers have been around for centuries, okay? These are like, there's not a new question out there that hasn't been answered over the last number of years. You know, Thomas Aquinas addressed like 10,000 questions, okay? So questions aren't new. But they don't want you to end up in the answers that I would give or Greg Kokel would give. They want you to end up somewhere else. So the deconstructionists, when you read through this, they don't like the apologists. And in fact, they strawman the apologists. I mean, at one point, this guy's talking about his one author in the book, because it's a book full of different chapters by different authors. And the one author, he references an apologist, and he says, "The apologist took me to the book of Job and said, 'Who are you to talk back to God?'" Like, that was the apologist response. I'm thinking, give me a break. I don't know a single apologist, and I track with a few of them, you know, who would tell someone who asked a question, "Who are you to talk back to God?" That's not where we go, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, I'm reading through this book, and my wife knows when I'm reading something that I don't agree with. I mean, and we should all do this. We should read stuff we agree with, but we should also read stuff we don't agree with, just so we understand the other side. And man, it puts me in a bad mood. Like, there are times I'll read for an hour and have to get up and walk my dog, you know, because I am just fuming. And Greg, you're going to see what I'm talking about.
Kick your dog.
Yeah. That's, I can't do that. My dog is 8 pounds and I could, yeah.
Yeah, I'll hurt something if you did that. By the way, let me interject something here that I heard from you that I think is a good, offers a kind of an accurate way of looking what's going on with deconstruction, because taking the pieces of Christianity, mm-hmm, and asking questions about their legitimacy is not something that bothers us.
No.
And every Christian has to do that with certain aspects of their convictions. Mm-hmm. In fact, everybody has to do that. Who is it that said the unexamined faith is not worth holding?
Yeah.
And he wasn't, I think that was Socrates or somebody like that, or the unexamined beliefs are not worth holding, something to that effect. So, but you made the distinction between people who are looking for answers and people who are looking for exits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a great way to put it.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to use it sometime in a book, and I'll probably have to footnote you, but it's still
Perfect. Very
nicely put, because there is a difference between those who are experiencing doubts and are wanting to have the doubts resolved with good answers.
Yeah.
Between them, the difference, and those who are encouraged to doubt in order to get rid of beliefs that that individual doesn't like and agree with.
Yeah.
And that's why you said over and over, "Oh, this thing, get rid of that. Oh, that, no, that's got to go. No, this, because this doesn't comport with something else."
Mm-hmm.
And what we are trying to do is take the classical view, which is biblically taught, and then give reasons why you ought to trust it.
Yeah.
But they're trying to do is give you a different theology and telling you to abandon the classic view. But my question is going to be, why? Mm-hmm. Why should I believe your version of the truth rather than Paul's or Jesus' version of the truth? Because that's really what's being offered here.
Yeah.
Leave that, adopt this. Why? This is our second Columbo question. Why? Why? How did you come to the conclusion that this is a wrong view, the one that classical Christianity teaches, and yours is the right view?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so much we could talk about when it comes to this issue. I've been making tons of notes. One thing that relates to this idea of questions seeking answers versus questions seeking exits is the idea of our next reality conference the theme is going to be about seek and you shall find. That's like next season, you know. And we're going to talk about deconstruction. We're going to talk about doubt, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And what I did a survey of the New Testament a couple of weeks ago and just looked at every case where the word seek was used. I was just curious. And what I found was there's those classic texts about seek and you will find, okay? And Jesus says that. There is Acts 17, you know, God's not far from any of us, you know, if we seek after him, this kind of thing, then you will find. So there's kind of like almost like this promise if you seek, but there's a certain kind of seeking. It's a seeking with all your heart.
Mm.
And what I found was there's these kind of seekers. I call them truth seekers.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also references to seeking in the New Testament that might surprise you. Like the Pharisees sought Jesus, but it wasn't because they were seeking to learn from him, or they were seeking to kill him. Why? Mm-hmm. Because he was upsetting their whole system. People were going to Jesus. They weren't coming to them, you know? And so there's a sense in which they weren't truth-seeking. They were self-seeking, you know? So there's different kinds of seekers in the, there's a lot of people seeking in the New Testament, but not all of it's good seeking. And what I find when you read some of these progressives, it doesn't matter kind of where you want to end up. It's just a matter of, as long as you're on the journey, as long as you're seeking, as long as you're deconstructing, that's what matters, you know?
Because is that the idea? Is because as long as you're deconstructing, you are moving away from this thing that we don't like. Where you end up going, that's a matter of individual choice, but as long as you don't stay where you're at. Am I reading you correctly in that?
Well, it depends. I think there's different people in this deconstructionist kind of movement, and there are some who say it doesn't matter where you end up. You can end up in atheism, in agnosticism, in some other religion, in progressive Christianity, it doesn't matter. That's a certain kind of deconstructionist, okay, that I think doesn't really care about truth, okay? They're a deconstructionist more in the postmodern idea, because they don't care where you end up.
Right.
There are others, like I think the authors of this book, or at least some of the authors in this book, who they want you to end up in progressive Christianity. So there's a sense in which they think their new theology is true, okay? Mm-hmm. Seems like they care about truth, at least their truth. And I'm going to read some quotes to you and get your
right. Thoughts. Well, see, now that's the issue. On the one hand, you talked about the postmodernists. They don't care where you land. And then and then you've got these people who want you to land on their truth, which is also kind of relativistically characterized there.
Yeah.
Except for the consistent relativist would say, whatever. As long as it's yours. It's like gender. There are 50 genders now. Whatever. Yeah. What matters is what you believe inside, okay? Mm-hmm. But there is a group of people here that are kind of saying whatever, kind of, but not really. Whatever, it's our stuff that we want you to be into and not that. Incidentally, maybe it would be helpful for our listeners just for you to give a thumbnail sketch, 30 seconds or so, of what a progressive Christian is.
Oh, sure. So a progressive Christian is someone who would deny many of the historic Christian doctrines. I'm using the term progressive Christian, and I don't think that they're actual Christians, mm-hmm. okay? Because they're denying, I think, historic Christian beliefs. And some of them are central beliefs. We're not just talking about debates over the age of the earth here mm-hmm. or end time stuff. We're talking about the deity of Christ. We're talking about the exclusivity of Christ. We're talking about whether God exists or not. Some of these guys call themselves hopeful agnostics. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. We're talking about encouraging certain kinds of sexual behavior that the Bible calls sin. So I think that these would be people who hold to a certain set of beliefs. And usually the progressive Christian, you know, they would deny hell. Virtually all of them are universalists in some respect. They hold a certain view of sexuality that is no different from the culture's view of sexuality. They hold a view of, some kind of inclusivism. You know, Jesus isn't the only way. All roads lead to God.
The authority of the Bible, that's out the door.
You authority know, of the Bible. Care. Yeah, so you go through and there's just and you that's what the chapters in this book are defending these new progressive views when it comes to.
So it sounds to me like this is the way I kind of sum it up, is that it is maintaining the name Christian and a veneer of Christianity, mm-hmm. and yet at the same time not holding to any Christian view that is in any way offensive to leftist culture.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine anything that I know that progressives hold to be so that would in any way, shape, or form bother anyone in the leftist culture, which is a progressivist culture.
Yeah.
So they're basically progressive in all their views, but they've got Jesus in there somehow championing all these progressive views.
And a great book on this is Elisa Childers' book, Another Gospel. Yeah, and that's what it comes down to. It is another gospel. And that's why we're, you know, not mincing our words. We're not going to pull punches. This really is another gospel. Mm-hmm. What I've realized is it's actually just the emergent church movement with a new label. As I read through this, and these guys are citing Rob Bell, they're citing Brian McLaren, the guys who are leading the emergent movement, which kind of, you don't hear about it anymore. And that's because it's wearing a new name, a new label, mm-hmm. A new outfit. It's progressive Christianity. That's what they're calling it. And it's like the CRT stuff, the critical theory, that's in this too. You find that, man, if you are an oppressor, you have less access to truth. But if you are oppressed, then that lived experience somehow gives you more access to truth, whatever that is.
It's funny you mentioned CRT, because that's a thing, that acronym has gone by the wayside now because it's got such bad press. People are saying, we're not teaching CRT, we're teaching equity and inclusion, or EI, and then there's another word they have, and there's all these other acronyms they have, but it turns out to be the same thing under a different name, just like your progressive Christianity is basically the postmodern crowd under a new guise, same theology. And the theology, ironically, it is liberal theology from 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a couple of new twists to it because we've got the sexual variations now that weren't on the table 100 years ago the way they are now. But anyway, so we're going to go to break in about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll get our callers that are left on board. But I want you to, what were some of those things that made your blood boil there, Tim?
So there's a chapter in the book on doubt, and that was interesting to me. Actually, I just gave a talk on doubt to some high schoolers on the weekend, so I thought, this is interesting. Let's read this book, this chapter on doubt. And what was fascinating was he starts, and he needs this. I mean, he's got to start with his conclusion so he can get there. And his conclusion is that everyone needs to doubt all of their beliefs. Doubt everything. And so what he does is he goes to 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21, which says, which people will know it as, test everything, hold fast to what is good. And you're thinking, well, what does that have to do with doubt? Well, he translates that, doubt everything, hold fast to what is good. And now what he's going to do is create a whole system of thought that if you want to follow Paul's command here, what you need to do is doubt everything. And that doesn't include just the stuff you disagree with. It includes the stuff that you hold near and dear, your fundamental beliefs.
I think we lost Tim there for a minute.
So, okay,
we'll
now here's what I didn't tell you.
We're going to recycle.
Can you hear me okay?
Recycled,
it says something about unstable connection.
The point, we have talked about this particular passage that Tim's referring to, and I don't want to spoil, a walk on his punchline here, but I'll tell you one thing that surprises me. Oh, there, you're back with us, Tim. Okay, let me just finish my thought, because I didn't step in your punchline at all here. But it's so interesting. Here is a progressive Christian that doubts and, in fact, rejects all of classical Christianity. So how do you get there when you don't believe in the authority of the Bible? You find a Bible verse that you can use as a springboard to move to the point of rejecting the authority of Bible verses. So there's a suicide tactic in play here. You know, what he's doing is essentially practically self-refuting. But I know why he does it, Tim, is because what he wants is Christians, he wants for Christians who believe the Bible not to believe the Bible on all these issues. Well, how do you get them to begin doubting the Bible? You quote a Bible verse to them that teaches them to doubt Bible verses, or that's the way he construes it. So he's starting with their source of authority, and he's then using it to undermine their authority by going to these different areas and casting doubt. But his basic principle, like you said, circular. If he's going to say this is what the Bible teaches, well, then he's making a biblical assertion that he's going to play out in particular ways. But I thought it was kind of odd that he would say, oh, well, this is what the Bible teaches. And my question is, well, why is it that you care? You're a progressive Christian. Anyway, John, I think you might be muted, Tim. I don't know. Are you? I don't read lips here, Tim. You're still working on it. You're going to be working on that. So I just thought that was just when you have a mic, just bark in here and jump in, and I'll know that it's time for me to stop talking. So we're still working on Tim. I got his lovely face back, but I don't have his marvelous squeaky voice. So we'll have that back here in just a second. But I point this out because, first of all, not only is it slick, but it's rhetorically clever because it is finding common ground with the believer. Oh, you believe the classical believer, the real Christian. You believe in the Bible. Okay, I'm going to give you a Bible verse that you can believe. I will twist and distort it in a certain way and make it sound like Paul is saying something that he's not actually saying. And then I'm going to use that with you to destroy Paul. And destroy Jesus and Peter and the whole raft of them. So anyway, this verse in mind, and Tim's still working on that. This verse is in 1 Thessalonians 5. And I was this was a passage, ironically, that I memorized almost 50 years ago, 47 years ago. I was a brand new Christian, and I was in a summer outreach project. For that project, excuse me, it was in Hawaii, in Waikiki. It was evangelistic discipleship-oriented, 10 weeks there. And we had to memorize all of 1 Thess 5. And this passage is in that chapter. I still pretty much remember most of it. Though most of the verses that I know by heart, I don't know because I tried to memorize it. My poor daughter is taking a test today on Bible verses she is supposed to memorize. She's a freshman in high school at a Christian school, and she's having her finals. She was laboring over these verses, and one of the verses was right here in 1 Thess 5. There's one that I was familiar with because I memorized it so long ago. But most of the time, and I think I mentioned this on the air, most of the time, when I know a verse, I don't know a verse because I memorized it. I know a verse because I read it a bunch of times. It meant a lot to me, and it just stuck. And I'm trying to help my daughter memorize a verse. I say, honey, I don't know how to do this. I'd never really been able to do it very well. But thank God, my mind is sticky for Bible verses, and a lot of things just make so much sense. They mean so much to me. They minister to the needs of my heart so aggressively that they just stick. They're there. Pray always and everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Do not despise prophetic utterance, but examine everything carefully. And now we don't have him back. Okay, so that means Tim's gone for the duration. Well, I can still look at his face here. We just can't get, for some reason, we can't get him. You know what? Why doesn't Tim just call this number? He can call the international number, and then we'll just take him on the phone. But the thing is like, can I take two people at once? Yeah, I can. No, I can't do that. Can I? Okay, well, now I got to step on Tim's line here because we don't have him back, and so I'm just going to go ahead and finish out his point. And if we get him back, then we'll be able to, he can add to it. But his point is, this verse doesn't mean what that progressive teacher says it means. When you read the verse, here's the magic words, in context, we find out it's referring to something entirely different. Okay, so I actually just did, from memory, recite that passage. So let me read it again to you. Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Do not quench the Spirit. Do not despise prophetic utterances. Okay, so it sounds like he's saying don't quench the spirit by despising prophetic utterances. So he's saying don't do that. Okay, what do you do with prophecy then? Next verse, but rather, by contrast to despising it, examine everything carefully. Hold fast to what is good. Abstain from every form of evil. That's the verse that Tim was talking about. Tim was talking about this guy citing the passage that says, examine everything carefully, and he translates it himself as doubt everything. If you're going to examine it, that means you must be doubting it. So we should read doubting it. Doubt everything. Doubt everything is the way he reads it. Well, that's not Paul's intent here when you read it in the context. It is examine all the prophetic utterances so that you don't dismiss some that are actually the Spirit and therefore quench the Spirit, verse 19. Rather, examine it carefully, and then that which is good, hold fast to it. All right? There you have it. So this is a classic violation. Six what? Oh, line six. Okay. All right, there you go. Mr. Tim.
Can you hear me?
I can. Okay, nicely. And I have to apologize. I've stolen all your fire here by explaining mentioning the context. Okay, good. Go ahead. Did you hear what I was saying, though?
Yeah, yeah.
Could you follow? Okay, great. Okay, pick it up where I left off then. Mr. B.
Well, okay, so what they've done is they had to redefine this word, so doubt everything. Now what he does is once he wants you to doubt everything, he wants to give examples in Scripture of doubters. And of course our audience is thinking, that's easy. You go to Thomas, you go to one of the disciples, maybe John the Baptist.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Yeah, that's a go-to. No. He goes to Jesus himself. He calls Jesus the poster child of doubt.
Oh, my goodness.
In fact, he refers to Jesus, and I quote, as a existential atheist on the cross. So when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? He is having an existential crisis, a doubt that that God is there, you know. This is, Greg, when I read that, my jaw was like on the ground. Is that the best treatment of that passage of Jesus on the cross? You know what I'm saying?
Of course. I'm borderline speechless myself because it never occurred to me. Though I know this verse is mysterious to a lot of Christians,
sure.
No one concludes from that Jesus was some kind of existential atheist at that moment. I've heard some unusual things like, this is when God turned his back on Jesus, which is an anthropomorphism that, you know, we got to be really careful.
Sure.
There's a split in the Trinity, like the Father split from the Son, which is not possible anyway. And the simplest way to deal with that is to note that Jesus' statement there is the first line of a psalm. Psalm 22, is that right?
Yes, right.
And so then you keep reading, and here's what it says. It says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. And then there's more that follow, and this is a classic psalm from David that articulates details that capture the crucifixion hundreds of years before crucifixion. They pierced my hands and my feet, you know, my bones. You can read the passage. I don't know it all, but I know this verse. And it's clear that what he means is that where are you? I am not being rescued. That's all it means.
Yeah.
It means there's nothing else going on. I actually had a teacher once that thinks that Jesus quoted the whole psalm on the cross, because at the very end, the last line is, and he of the psalm is, he has accomplished it, which kind of sounds like it is what?
It is finished.
It is finished, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He has accomplished it. So I don't know if that's really what happened, but it's clear that the psalm is speaking of the crucifixion prophetically, and Jesus is participating in the agony of the psalmist for the reason the psalmist was agonizing. He was suffering, yeah, and God wasn't rescuing him. That's not that hard.
Yeah.
He wasn't obviously doubting.
Yeah.
Anything that is not of faith is sin. So if he's doubting, then he's sinning. And there goes your Christology.
Yeah. This is, wow, this is, I mean, and when I can think of all the explanations, even if it's a tricky passage, for someone to conclude that he was an existential atheist, it's just, I mean, that's just not right. You know, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that jumped out, of course. So they want you to doubt everything. In another chapter, another author in the book appeals to experience again, and maybe you were making some comments about this while I was.
I know this is coming. Okay. So this is your opportunity here. Carrie, take this one away.
Okay, so. In a little paragraph, and the heading is "Trust the God in You." Okay, they're going to get you to. They want you to doubt some of the things that are in Scripture because Scripture is not reliable on this view; it's not trustworthy. What they want you to do is trust your experience,
except for 1 Thessalonians 5, when it says, "Doubt all things." Yeah. That is divinely inspired.
This is where the picking and choosing, the inconsistency is really showing itself. They talk about how when we answer the problem of evil, we may appeal to some kind of mystery going on. But then at the same time, they kind of chastise they'll chastise us for appealing to mystery. And then when they want to, you know, appeal the mystery, it's okay. And so there's kind of like this inconsistency that happens over and over again. So let me just read this, and our audience can just listen and see if you can spot a problem here. It says, as you are in community with God and others, trust in your experience. I know that experience gets such a bad rap, but unfortunately, the alternative is to trust everyone else's experience and how they interpret the Scriptures, God, and reality. My hope is that, just like the Apostle Paul did, you will allow God's perfect, moment-to-moment, uncontrolling, and cooperative love lead you into truth. Mm-hmm. And so it's your experience that's going to lead you into truth. He goes on to say, well, I mean, where would we get this from? Well, he says, look, Paul, who wrote a lot of the New Testament, he says 28% didn't quote from the Gospels. He didn't say Jesus said this, or he wasn't like some Christians will do. No, what does he do? He goes to his experience. In fact, says this: still, rather than memorizing and quoting what others said about Jesus or what others said Jesus said, Paul spoke from his experience. It seems that out of the deep, intimate relationship he had with Jesus, Paul spoke his truth. And then the next step is, Paul spoke his truth, and guess what? You should speak your truth, okay? And just like Paul was inspired, we're all inspired by
man.
God.
Yeah,
because
remember,
the God is in you, right? So this is, anyways, this is,
well, there is so much we could talk about here. Well, we'll have to. Here's I'll give you my first thought, and then we're going to have to go to break and get some calls. So, and we're going to have to figure out how to include you in these calls, you know, because we've got a jury rig system here. Plus, my leg just pulled my camera plug out, and so I can't even see myself on the screen, and that's really bad news. So, all we got is your mug up there right now. So, what I thought of is he's doing the same thing he was doing earlier. He's saying, you got to trust your feelings, okay? You can't trust what other people say, other people's feelings, or other people's interpretation. You have to trust your own. How do I know that? Let me give you my take and my interpretation of what Paul did with Jesus' words and how he worked in the Bible and what Jesus said at the cross. Now trust my take on that and apply it to your own life. In other words, he's doing exactly the very thing he's encouraging people not to do. Of course, the difference is he's encouraging the Christians not to trust other people's conventional, classical take of the scriptures, but rather reach inside of yourself and you'll see that my take is the right take. And I can tell you why he's confident of that, because his road is the easy road. It's the wide road. It's the road that gets no pushback from anybody.
Yeah.
You're not going to run into any trouble. It's all politically correct, and it comports with all of our fleshly desires. Of course it's going to feel better than going the narrow road of self-denial, your hand on the plow, being a disciple. Anyway, let me break here. Okay, Tim, I know, like, sure. I can see your face. You got lots more to say here. Let's just take a break. I'll fix my stuff on this end. We'll take a few more calls and then probably call it a day. We got a lot to talk about in the last half hour. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
Do you know that killing an unborn human being is against the law in most states? The only exception is when the mother wants her child dead and asks a doctor to kill it. Then it's legal, it's protected, it's funded by our tax dollars. And today, the freedom to choose is even celebrated. We live in a world where a woman decides whether another innocent and defenseless human being lives or dies. But is it that simple? Don't women have a right to control their own bodies? Can't many poor women not afford to have another baby? Should a woman who was raped be forced to carry the criminal's baby? It's complicated. It's chaos. But there's a solution. There's a way to make sense of the confusion. We need to anchor our thinking about abortion to reality. Then we'll see how we can help both unborn human beings as well as our born mothers who face a difficult decision. Join us for this year's Reality Conference, where we'll see how the solution to abortion will bring clarity to the chaos. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the Student Apologetics event of the year.
Do you want to become a more knowledgeable Christian ambassador without sitting through a formal course on apologetics? Well, we've made that possible for you through our STR Quick Reference app. Available for free on iTunes and Google Play, the STR Quick Reference app holds a wealth of information summarizing what you need to know on a range of topics. Learn how to defend the faith, see how other worldviews compare to Christianity, and master the biblical view of morality, all through short, engaging videos. Before you know it, you'll be well-versed on a number of important apologetics topics. In addition, the Quick Reference app also includes a Bible with text and audio, as well as some featured STR resources, all to enhance your learning experience. The STR Quick Reference app will equip you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the key issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Visit iTunes or the Google Play Store today and download the STR Quick Reference app. And if you enjoy the app, make sure you give it a 5-star review.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available, both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
All right, back at you here, Greg Kokel. And we still don't have my face. We can figure out how to do that. And we did, I think we figured out how to get you on, Tim. Now, if this doesn't work, then you go to the Twilight Zone for the rest of the show. I'm just saying. So I'm going to double click you, and then I'm going to double click Katie in Las Vegas and see if it works. Hold on.
Okay.
Katie? Katie. Oh, goodness. I double clicked the wrong one. Katie.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Can you hear that, Tim?
Yeah.
Oh, it works.
Yay!
Actually, the button comes up blue, too. That's even like, it looks like Christmas. I got red and green and blue here. I got, and yellow.
Sweet.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Thank you so much for waiting, Katie. You're very patient. How can we help you?
Well, I actually am going to be real quick so you can get on to the next callers. I just wanted to first tell you that you are an awesome writer. I'm reading your book, Tactics, right now, and I'm actually listening to the audiobook, and the fact that you are the one narrating it is the coolest thing ever. Just kind of sick. It's really nice to hear the voice I'm used to from these podcasts telling me the words you actually wrote. So
well, thank
cool.
you.
Yeah.
Well, that's thank you. I really appreciate that. Thanks. I have a policy now. I make a couple of extra, you know, nickels and dimes from that effort, but it is a lot of work to do that. But I've had so many people that told me that this makes a big difference because my voice is familiar to many because of the podcast that I'm just, from now on, every book that I write, I'm going to read it myself.
That's awesome. I'm so glad to hear that. I'm excited to read the rest of your books that you talk about in that book. So that's going to be great.
Okay, good. So tell me what's on your mind, Kate.
So the only other thing I wanted to ask you was in reading that book, which has been just awesome, by the way, there's all kinds of stuff I never thought of. There's part of your tactics that you talk about, especially with using other people's world views against, not against them, but to be able to defend your own point.
Uh-huh.
There's a pastor that I listen to on a regular basis. His name is Jeff Durbin. He's in Arizona, and he's part of Apologia Studios, Apologia Church. And he seems to be like your poster child for the way that you describe how to use these tactics. And I was just wondering if there's any chance that, A, you've heard of him, B, maybe he knows you and actually learned from you, or if he just happens to be good at your tactics without it.
Well, a couple of thoughts on this really quickly. I the name sounds familiar to me. I don't know. Tim, have you heard of Jeff Durbin?
Yeah. Jeff is amazing at interacting with Mormons and I think maybe Jehovah's Witnesses. He's the kind of guy that goes like Ray Comfort, man on the street, and interacts with people who disagree with him.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know Jeff, and I don't know if he has read the Tactics book or not. He might have, but also, in a certain sense, the tactics, especially the Colombo tactic, this goes back 400 years before Christ to a guy named Socrates, right? The Socratic method. And so what I did is I just took that and I formalized it, organized it in a very particular way to make it usable as a game plan by people. But there are a lot of people who have learned how to use questions effectively and without ever reading my book. In fact, there's an atheist who's done it too. His name is Peter Boghossian, and he's written a book called, what is it called, Tim? A Manual for Creating Atheists or something to that effect? Is that
That's
it?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And
you talk about that in your book. You actually talk about that specific thing, and I think that's fantastic that you bring him up.
Well, that just shows that there's a universal quality to these approaches, to this broader approach and some of the techniques that I use. So I'm not surprised if people who have never read the Tactics book are actually using some of the things that I talk about there. So, and then maybe someday I'll get a chance to meet Jeff Durbin. I don't know. He's not that far away. He's in Phoenix, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
He's in Arizona. I don't know if it's, I think it might be Tucson, but he is like Tim was saying, he is phenomenal at the art of controlling a conversation. And it was just, as I was reading your book, he was almost like the video that goes with the audio at the point.
Well, that's good. I prefer to refer to it as managing the conversation. You know, curling has kind of a negative connotation, but I think it is
You're
a management,
right.
And this is we're trying to. In fact, we had a little role play in our staff meeting today where Tim went after me with something, and how would you respond to this? I said, okay, Tim, let's just role play it a little bit, and that we did, and it worked out nicely. Anyway, okay, thank you, Katie, for your call, and I'm going to say goodbye.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm going to drop you here and see. I still have you, Tim. Is that right?
You got it.
Okay, so then I double click, let's go to Richard. I think he's next here. Double click Richard. Oh, Richard went blue too. That's a good sign. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yes, I wanted to know, how do you reconcile the two Christmas stories? Because Luke chapter 2 explains why Joseph went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth, and then it goes through after the circumcision, Mary's days of purification.
Right.
She went to the temple, and she couldn't afford a lamb, so she brought two doves or pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they returned right to Galilee to Nazareth. Whereas Matthew has, just as a matter of fact, he was born in Bethlehem, and then the Magi came, and they were warned, and Joseph was warned in
goes
dream
to
go to Egypt, and then an angel told Joseph, return to Israel, but in verse 22, Joseph was afraid of Archelaus reigning in Judea.
Right.
He was warned in a dream, so instead he went to Galilee, into Nazareth. So
right. Remember, Galilee is
there. There's wealth, and there's, well, it seems like they started out in Bethlehem in Matthew, and then in Luke they started out in Nazareth.
Sure,
so how
yeah.
do you reconcile all that?
Right.
Stuff?
Remember, Galilee is a region, and Nazareth is a city in the region of Galilee. But, Tim, what's your take on that? Mr. B.
This is a good question. I mean, I haven't done a ton of research and trying to reconcile this. So I'd be interested in your take, Greg. I know that for some people, I just haven't done digging into this particular challenge. But I know for some people, this is like a big contradiction.
Sure.
or discrepancy.
Okay.
I don't know if there's a bona fide. I mean, when it comes to these kinds of things, I want the explicit. What is the explicit contradiction? Because my impulse immediately, just because I've seen how other things can be reconciled in Scripture, when I come upon something like this, my instinct is to immediately assume that there must be a contradiction. What I want to see is there some way of reconciling this, even if it may be. Strange or, it maybe not totally intuitive. So that's kind of my first impulse is to do that. But I'm actually, when it came up, I thought, hey, I want to hear what Greg has to say about this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's really not, I don't think it's difficult when you understand the way ancient Near Eastern biographies were written. And this is characteristic of the Gospels. It's an ancient Near Eastern biography, all right? And when you have biographies, sometimes things are not in order. And in the case of Luke, he said, I put them in order. But in order doesn't necessarily mean there aren't gaps, okay? And so when Luke says, I've put them all together here in the first chapter, he says, seem fitting for me as well, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so you'd know the exact truth about the things you've been taught. So more than the others, you're going to get a sequential series of events in the life of Jesus. Now, there still might be some disorder, but generally speaking, they're going to be sequential. That isn't the way, characteristically, these accounts were written, especially when the biographies were meant to make a point, okay? They were meant to accomplish an end, a certain kind of goal. And there's a theological point that each of the writers is making with regards to the life of Jesus. And so they're going to take, generally speaking, different things and group them in different ways. We don't do that nowadays. That's not our style. But for us to assess the Gospels by today's standards is to be guilty of anachronism, reading a present thing into the past where it doesn't belong. All right. So one of the things that you're going to have in these situations is you're going to have some details that are left out, and you will go from one set of circumstances to another set of circumstances where in between those two sets is a third set of circumstances that another gospel identifies. And so when you put all of these things together, you get the most contiguous characterization of all of the events in question. Now, the way to understand, I think, the difference between the Lucan account and the Matthew account is actually very simple. All right? You cited all of these things that happened fairly sequentially in the life of Joseph and Mary. Jesus is born, then they go, and they have to buy the turtle dove. Why?
They're poor.
Oh, wait a minute. What about Shadrach? No, not this. That's the wrong three.
They don't have names.
Manimo and Jack, right? The Eastern kings, right? We don't have their names. We don't even know how many there were. We think there were three. Why do you think we think there are three?
Three gifts,
which were first
gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
And and they're all like really valuable. So if Mary has to go and get turtle doves because she's poor, what do we know about the visitation of the Magi to Bethlehem to see the Christ child?
Either it happened later or they kept all those gifts in a separate account just for Jesus.
they put it in an IRA, an educational IRA. No, they hadn't arrived yet. So when you look at the account in Matthew, it says there, and I just know from memory, but I'll go to it. It says that the Magi came to the house.
Yeah.
Okay. Now my opinion is they always were in the house. They were just in the bottom, because when it says that there was no room for them in the inn, I'm trying to think of the Greek word kataluma or something like that. It means the upper room. There were no inns in Bethlehem. They didn't have a Motel 6 and a Hilton and all these things. There were no inns. You stayed with family members. But when he got there, Joseph and Mary, there was no room. There was no place for them to stay in the upper area of the house where they usually stay. They had to stay down in the bottom of the house where the animals were kept. Okay, so that's the circumstance. And it says there when the Magi came, they came to the technon, the child, not the infant, the child. So probably what's going on here is you have Luke and that account, and it explains all of those things that happened very immediately after the birth of Jesus. And then Matthew includes details that happen afterwards that Luke doesn't include. Luke jumps from there right to Nazareth because his purpose was not to talk about these other things. It was irrelevant to Luke and his purpose that Jesus spent a couple of years or whatever with the family down in Egypt. But in Matthew, this is stated clearly, and part of the reason is because they include there the execution by the Romans of all these children. And this had prophetic significance, and Matthew is written principally to Jews. So Matthew includes that, about Rachel weeping for her children, and the numbers were probably rather small. Maybe half a dozen to a dozen children were killed. But notice the ages. What were the ages of the children that Herod had killed?
Less than 2 years.
Yes, up to 2 years.
Up to two.
That's a lot of time. And it was based on the appearance of the star. That's what they, from the time they saw the star. And so what he's doing is he's just trying to, you know, cover all his bases. Likely, Jesus was there in Bethlehem for a while before this incident happened, and they were told to go to Egypt. They were there for a few years, and then they go to the Galilee to move to Nazareth, and that's where Luke picks up the narrative. There is no contradiction. They're not two different stories. There is just another detail, more detail in Matthew that's given to the larger story than is given in Luke. It's not even contradictory. They dovetail perfectly.
In Luke 2:39, it says, when they had performed all things according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own city of Nazareth. So you're saying, well, also they went to Egypt before?
Yes.
Luke 2:39?
Yes, yes. Because he's just speaking sequentially there. He's, what he's not communicating, and I'll tell you the reason I know this, he is not communicating that after the turtle dove incident, they left.
Because it sure but sounds like it. When
no,
they,
I know
they,
it
when
does.
When they've done all the things according to the law.
Right.
And he talks about the law with the turtle doves and uncleanness and all that and going to the temple. That seems like he says they're doing it according to the law.
Correct. Yeah, they did that, everything. And then, and here's what I'm going to say, sometime subsequent to that, he picks up the narrative with them going back to the Galilee and to Nazareth. What we don't realize just by reading that account is there's a big event that happens in between. And incidentally, this is not unusual in the Gospels. There are other occasions where this happens as well, okay, when Jesus is cursing the fig tree. And then they see, well, look at the fig tree. It withered. And then Jesus gives them a message regarding the fig tree. But in the other account, we realize he does the curse, they go to town, and they come back. And when they come back, they see the fig tree is withered, and then they have this conversation. So it's not unusual in this kind of narrative to skip big sections that are not important to the writer that other writers supply. And the reason I know they didn't go right away to Nazareth right after the turtle dove incident is because Matthew tells us differently. And that's completely consistent with the way these kinds of accounts were written at the time. There's no contradiction, and it's not a separate story. There's a detail in Matthew that's a big detail that is included that Luke did not concern himself with. Luke is written more to Greeks anyway. He was a Greek. And so he's not going to talk about this detail of all these children dying, that is a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. He just picks it up when they go there, and then he follows the events after Jesus and Jesus and Mary and Joseph, you know, head to Nazareth. So that's, I mean, there's some people that aren't going to be satisfied with that, and I, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know what to say to them. But
well, that's your answer.
Okay, that's my answer, and you can compare the two accounts. There's not a contradiction. There is a lacuna, so to speak, or a hole in the account that Luke does, in Luke's account, that Matthew fills in. And I'll tell you, this is characteristic of that kind of writing. It is the genre, all right? There's our music, Tim, and my apologies to the other callers we weren't able to get to. I'll be back, sans Tim, probably next week, and I can take your calls then if you want to call back. Tim, thanks for sharing the show with me, buddy. Oh, his sound is gone again, but he's smiling, so that's a good sign. Greg Kokel with Tim Barnett here for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.